And joining us right now, funny timing, is one of the people that Senator Durbin would say is, quote, in the pro-life column. This is Scott Jennings. He's a conservative commentator, my colleague over at CNN, also writes for USA Today and the Los Angeles Times. He served in the Bush 43 White House and as an advisor to Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Mr. Jennings, how you doing?
Elliot, my brother. Good to chat with you. Thanks for having me.
As always. Now, tell me this. So what, I don't know if Dick Durbin tends to be Scott Jennings' muse on matters of abortion. However, he did make the point there that sort of typical allies on this issue are sort of struggling to understand where the president, the former president, stands on it. Are you similarly confused, or what do you think about Trump's announcement?
Well, look, I think what he basically did was restate the status quo. I mean, what he said is what's happening now, you know, that the states are making decisions about these matters. You know, what he didn't explicitly say, but what is also true, is that there's really no political reality right now for the federal government to do anything. I mean, to me, it was somewhat honest. You know, this is going to be left to the states. What he didn't say was, because there's not 60 votes in the Senate today, nor mm-hmm. will there be in the near future, to change national policy, whether you want it liberalized or whether you want a national ban of some kind. Now, what Joe Biden says is, vote for me and I'll restore Roe versus Wade, which is a complete farce. And so I actually think Trump's got an honest position here. The trouble politically is that, you know, if you say, I'll just live with whatever the states do, I don't have any personal views, then the opposition campaign is going to, of course, stick you with whatever the states do, which obviously they're doing in the case of Arizona today and other places.
Why do you say Biden's position is, quote, a complete farce? What do you mean about that?
He is saying, I mean, his campaign often says, vote for me and I will restore Roe versus Wade. You and I both know that's a dishonest statement, because no abortion bills are passed in Congress, okay? There will not be a 60-vote consensus in the Senate to do anything on abortion. And so what he's arguing is, to people who may not know better, is that if you vote for him, he can unilaterally do it. He cannot. He cannot, and he will not. But he will demagogue on the issue, which is, of course, what they're doing today.
Now, what do you make of the fact that, say, for instance, Lindsey Graham, a longtime ally of the president, interestingly, the Susan B. Anthony list sort of came out quite critically of Trump's statement. Susan B. Anthony list being a major, so what we want to call them, anti-abortion organization.
Yeah.
What do we make of that?
Well, look, there are people in the pro-life movement who want the president, a Republican president, in this case, maybe Donald Trump, to make a forceful moral case, a moral argument about why we must end abortion and limit abortions to the extent possible. That's what they want. They have their view is someone should not be viewing this transactionally. They should be viewing it as a moral, deeply held value. Trump does not hold this as a deeply held value. It's always been very transactional with him.
Yeah,
you even heard him yesterday.
That was going to be my question. What are Trump's deeply held values?
He said it in his statement.
Yeah.
We must win elections.
Right.
We must win elections. And he's appealing to the pragmatists, saying, well, look, it's Biden and Trump. And I guess with Trump, even though he doesn't really care about this emotionally the way I do, I'll probably get fewer abortions with Trump than I will with Biden. Therefore, I'll vote with Trump. I mean, that's the big political gambit they're running here, is that the pro-lifers, whether your nose is out of joint today or not, they'll come running back when faced with the prospect of another 4 years of Joe Biden.
Tell me this. Let's stay on this coming back question. And this whole, even Trump leading across the polls in a number of battleground states, what's the likelihood you think that Democrats or even some of the moderates that maybe flipped over and voted for Joe Biden, quote unquote, come back? Like, how much do you trust polling right now that has Trump consistently across the winning a lot of these battlegrounds?
Well, I trust it as much as I can average it. And so, if you have lots of quality data and you can average it, and I trust trends, you can see things moving up and down. And I think Trump does have a small lead in most of the swing states. And I do believe that Biden has softness among a lot of demographics. You know, to me, the biggest poll number I saw in the last few days just jumped off the page at me, the Marquette Law School National Poll. They had a head-to-head. I think they had them 50-50. But inside that, it was fascinating, Elliot. Among registered voters who were certain to vote, Biden led 52-48. But registered voters who were not certain but maybe would vote, Trump had, you know, like a 7 or 8 point lead. And then you get down to not registered, and Trump was up like 66-34. It was crazy. And so the old paradigm in politics right now is falling away. We used to think that higher turnout benefited Democrats. Everybody always said it. Everybody thought it. It was conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
I actually think the truth is different this election. I think if Trump can mobilize these infrequent voters or even register new people, he's quite likely to outstrip the polls, to outrun the polls that you're referencing by putting new people into the pool that pollsters may be missing.
This is Scott Jennings, conservative commentator. That was Scott Jennings, conservative commentator. This is Elliot Williams in for Julie Mason today. Scott, switching gears a little bit, we were talking earlier in the program with Kadia Goba about what's going on in the House of Representatives and the sword of Damocles, as it were, to use Laura Coates' favorite expression, hanging over the head of Speaker Mike Johnson. And my question to you is, how serious is this push from Marjorie Taylor Greene and others to perhaps remove the speaker? Like, is this man going to have his job in 6 months?
I mean, I don't know. Well, in 6 months, gosh, I don't know.
Next week, I don't know.
But I think when the numbers are this close, you have to take it all seriously. I mean, what she's saying, in my opinion, is not serious. I don't think she's a serious person, and I think she says objectively crazy things. But when the numbers are this close and you can get a couple of folks to follow along, then, yeah, you know, your job could be in jeopardy. He could be dependent upon Democrats to try to protect the institution here and stop turning over the Speaker's office every few weeks. I think he's doing the best job he can do under the circumstances. I do think he's got a few things he's got to clear up here over the next few days. But it is serious because there are people out there who want to believe that nobody is as pure as what's right over the hill. You know, The grass is always greener. Let's just get another speaker. And now they never, ever, ever acknowledge reality. Democrats control the White House. Democrats control the Senate. And effectively, on many days, Democrats control the House because of the way, you know, a chunk of the Republican conference acts. Mike Johnson, if he had a magic wand and was emperor and had no government structure in which to deal, I'm sure he'd do a lot of things differently. But that's not the reality in which he lives. But I think in the reality, he's doing okay, particularly when you consider he's having to fight off crazy people every day.
You're sounding like a deep stater who's sort of drunk the Kool-Aid from the Clinton-Bush era, Scott. I don't know. You're just not the right-wing troll that I think people hope that you are. It's really it's probably heartbreaking.
What do you mean, Elliot? I am from the Bush era. I was federal assistant to George W.
Funny how that works, right? You know, I actually, we were talking about this a little bit early in the program. Part of me thinks that what you sort of have now in the House is these coalitions almost forming and requiring votes of the minority party, which is what they have in England and a lot of Europe, may not be a bad thing, right? This idea of forcing a chunk of voters from one party and a chunk from another to sort of come together may actually be a good thing for America. Now, I'm not foolish here, but I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, though, whether there actually is an upside to it being so close in the House that the majority party has to rely on the votes of the minority.
Well, these kinds of coalitions only work if the coalitions decide to hang together. The problem for Mike Johnson is that his coalition has a chunk of people, which, you know, ebbs and flows on any given day, that are ready to threaten, you know, the ruling piece of the coalition with expulsion if they don't get what they want. I mean, it's a coalition of hissy fits. And, you know, it's hard to manage a government that way. So I think functionally you're right. You know, it's functionally a coalition situation right now. You've got Republicans and then you've got this out faction of Republicans. But how could you ever possibly legislate and govern if, you know, one of your coalition partners is constantly threatening to overthrow you. I mean, in any normal situation, if it really were a coalition system, you'd be looking for another partner and saying, I get rid of these guys and I'll bring others in. I don't think the Democrats have a single person in their conference that would like to join a coalition government with any Republicans. For now, Johnson's stuck with it.
I think that's the vestige of we just have a two-party system that has to function like a multi-party system for the time being. But it's still a two-party system, and neither party really has an incentive to help the other guy out for a whole host of other reasons. But speaking of that, crossing lines and sort of strange bedfellows, Israel, Ukraine, foreign policy funding is also this area where I don't know where left and right even are anymore, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as to what the latest is with respect to Ukraine and Israel funding.
Well, of course, you know, I think we ought to help them both. They're both our allies, and they're both fighting, effectively terrorists, and they're both fighting people that hate America and would like to see bad things happen to America. I think it's in our best interest for the Russians to be turned away and for Hamas to be utterly and completely destroyed. So I would like to see us get to a place where we can help them both, and I hope Johnson and the rest of the congressional leaders get to a place where we can do that. I don't know if this loan idea is going to fly or not. Yeah. Forgivable loans, whatever. I mean, let's help these people. Turning back the Russians is good for America, and destroying Hamas is good for America. But boy, oh boy, there's a lot of people in Congress right now that seem to have trouble telling the good guys from the bad, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the final question is, what about the humanitarian costs in Gaza right now? And what do you make of, is that muddying some of these questions of good guy versus bad guy that you're talking about?
Well, you know, the humanitarian cost I'm principally worried about are the 1,200 people, who were murdered on October the 7th. The people who were taken hostage and are still being held hostage, we don't know their status. Some of those people are American citizens. You know, when I hear about humanitarian cost, I hear people throwing that around, but they never seem to get around to mentioning the hostages. So what I would like is for somebody, all these people want to blame and hold Israel accountable for everything, but I don't ever hear anyone say, well, you know, Hamas's responsibility in all this is dot, dot, dot. Well, here's their responsibility. Ceasefire now, release the hostages, and we can end this war. But they keep rejecting ceasefires, and as long as they do that, I don't want to hear it, the whining about the humanitarian cost, honestly. I think Israel, and I think the United States, and I think the international community are trying to do what they can on the humanitarian piece. I really believe that. I think Israel's getting a bad rap on it, and I think there are a lot of people out there who – your slip is showing, is all I'm saying when it comes to Israel and the Jewish people. I think a lot of this – a lot of this sentiment against Israel is predates this conflict, and it shows what's in a lot of people's hearts. That's my view.
Scott Jennings, always great to talk. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks, Elliot. See you, pal.
Take care. All right, that was Scott Jennings, conservative commentator over at CNN, where we work together, also USA Today, LA Times. He also served in the Bush 43 White House, as we talked about, and has been a longtime advisor to Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. We're going to take a break.